Good morning, this is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for regular host David Inge. Glad you could listen. One of the tragic ironies of 9/11 is the life and death of former FBI agent John O'Neill. O'Neill was the FBI's leading expert on Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, and was convinced there would be another Al-Qaeda attack on the World Trade Center in New York. He would end up leaving the FBI just days before September 11, 2001, to take a position as head of security at the World Trade Center, where he died along with more than 3,000 others. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about the life and career of John O'Neill, and along the way, learn more about the history of anti-terrorism in the U.S., its successes and failures. Our guest is investigative journalist Murray Weiss, the criminal justice editor at the New York Post and author of the book The Man Who Warned America, The Life and Death of John O'Neill, the FBI's Embattled Counterterror Warrior, recently published by Reagan Books. In the book, Murray Weiss tells of the rise and fall of O'Neill within the FBI and the efforts he made to change the way the U.S. government deals with international terrorism. The book also looks at O'Neill's personal contradictions and examines a number of controversies about his life and death. We will talk about that during this hour and welcome your questions. If you would like to join us, all you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. If you're listening outside of Champaign-Urbana, we have a toll-free line good anywhere in the United States. If you're listening on the web, you can also use that, 800-222-9455, anytime during this hour. And our guest, Murray Weiss, joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for having me on your show.
Good. Well, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it. Now, you knew John O'Neill personally, did you not?
I did, in my capacity as a journalist here in New York City and as a criminal justice editor of the New York Post. I met John O'Neill shortly after he came here from Washington to head the New York office's National Security Division. He had been the FBI's chief of counterterrorism at FBI headquarters, and then he came up here. Down there in 95, he identified Osama bin Laden as the greatest threat and tried getting everybody on board. Then he came here as the National Security Division chief in New York. Most people don't realize it, but the New York office of the FBI is not just its flagship office. All of the major terrorism cases are operationally run out of and led by the New York office, where there's an Al-Qaeda squad. And I do know most of your listeners are aware of all the bombers in the 1993, the first World Trade Center case, and Blind Sheikh Rahman. They were all indicted, arrested, and tried here in New York City. So John took over the counterterrorism programs here as the National Security Director and the counter-espionage. Although he became more famous in counterterrorism, he actually was in charge of all the, you know, anti-spy kind of stuff that was going on here regarding, you know, the United Nations, all the missions. But he became famous for the counterterrorism stuff. And I met him in my capacity as a reporter covering law enforcement and criminal justice here. And we were friends, but I can tell you that he was a very complicated man who went out on the town, and he had tons of friends. And after he died, everybody said, yeah, I knew John O'Neill. But the truth is, nobody really knew him. And while I knew him, and he was charming and brilliant, he was a secret agent in a secret world with a very compartmentalized private life. And it took me about a year and a half to begin to really see what an extraordinary man and complicated man he was personally, but I was amazed, really, to find out just where he was in the pantheon of all terrorism events. He was at the cutting edge of every single major terrorist event here and abroad during the last 6 years of his life, which was pretty much the heart of all of the growth of terrorism here and abroad.
Mm-hmm. Well, he spotted the threat posed by Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda before anyone else really was taking them seriously.
It's not an understatement to say that John O'Neill saw the dots and connected them before people even knew there were dots. As I mentioned, John O'Neill used to be the assistant special agent in charge in Chicago for about 3 or 4 years in the early 1990s, where actually he's credited with some tremendous out-of-the-box visionary kind of creations of task forces that attacked and broke up the gangs that had strangleholds over most of the city's projects. In that time, the murder rate was through the roof. I know they have problems there now with the murder rate again. But he was promoted to be the section chief for counterterrorism in Washington, and he drove to Washington from Chicago overnight on a Saturday evening. He arrives on a Sunday, classic John O'Neill. He goes right to his office, starts unpacking his stuff. He gets a call from the counterterrorism officials at the White House that they have a lead on Ramzi Youssef, then the world's most wanted fugitive, then the mastermind of the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center, the first one. And John, in 72 hours without sleeping, at the command center, orchestrates the capture of Ramzi Youssef and the return of him to the United States in an international rendition, which are very complicated affairs, getting host countries to correspond and work with the United States and get the military to have planes refuel in midair so that Ramzi Youssef never touches the ground anywhere but back here in New York. John, within weeks of that, recognized that that case and a number of other things that he was spotting, March of 1995, goes to a morning meeting at the FBI and becomes the first agent to say, and I quote people in my book who were there at these meetings, this is not, you know, fabrication or Murray Weiss's theories. I recreate his life, and you hear the director of the FBI, the assistant director, say, first time I heard it, John O'Neill, Osama bin Laden is the single greatest threat to the United States of America. And that over the next 6 years, John O'Neill led the investigation into the Khobar Towers attack in Saudi Arabia, the two bombings of U.S. embassies in Africa that killed 247 and wounded 5,000 others, the United States attack in Yemen on the United States coal. John led that case, and all the while telling people Osama bin Laden, the FBI, CIA, right through to the White House, trying to get them to recognize that Osama bin Laden had this vast network of jihadists who had fought in Afghanistan. They saw the United States. They beat the Russians. They saw the United States as devil number two, and they were coming here. And unfortunately for him, you know, and the country, most of his clarion call fell on deaf ears.
You say that he connected the dots before anyone else did, and we've mentioned the bombing of the World Trade Center in February of 1993. Why did, you know, pretty much at that point is you know, there were indications that there was such a thing as Al-Qaeda and that Osama bin Laden might have been connected to this whole enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And he suspected right away that bin Laden was going to attack the World Trade Center again. Why did he think that?
Well, he recognized that the Twin Towers represent were these enormous symbols of both our secular capitalistic universe. The tallest buildings in although I live in New York City, I think most people would agree, although maybe they'd want to debate it, that New York in many ways is the vast symbol of it's home to the financial community. it's the largest city. The towers represent everything about the United States, and he understood. You know, I have a great anecdote in my book. When they brought Ramzi Youssef back, and they flew him to a Stewart Air Force Base north of New York City, and then they flew him in a helicopter down to Manhattan to a federal correction facility behind the United States courthouses and the United States Attorney's Office. And when the agents took him past the World Trade Center, they lifted his blindfold to show him that the Twin Towers were still standing. And his remark, and I quote Lou Shalira, who later became the head of the New York office, who was in the helicopter with him, they took off his blindfold and they showed him the Twin Towers, and he said, and they go, see, they're still standing, and he said, they wouldn't be if I had more money. And the horror of that remark, which Lou Shalira, who was inside the World Trade Center in 1993 and saw the six-story hole in the basement, but he stood next to the huge pillars that held up the, you know, humongous twin towers, I mean, 108-story structures that traverse about six city blocks here in New York City. He never thought that the towers could come down, and he was talking to John O'Neill years later, and John was telling him they're going to keep coming, and they're going to keep coming until they take them down. And John recognized that the roots of that case ran through the Middle East, that the bin Laden extremists, you know, they're in a long war And the lessons of the book, actually, you know, and it's extraordinary. It was an extraordinary thing for me to learn these things along the way, and it's an extraordinary thing for me to piece them together and represent them in a book that's really like this action-packed, almost spy international terrorism historical novel. Mm-hmm. But it's all true. When you get to see where John O'Neill was on all these cases, you really get to see the failures and the vision at the same time. You know, his recognition that they would keep coming. Some of the things he fought against, you know, the CIA and the FBI with the walls coming down. He wanted the walls to come down. You can see almost all the pivotal points where he was on the right side trying to get people to wake up to what was going on. It's an incredible lesson, really, on what went wrong and what we should be doing now.
It's interesting to see how U.S. policy at the time in prosecuting acts of terror was certainly, I guess you would call it a criminal investigation kind of approach. They would investigate, identify subjects. Suspects and use diplomacy to try to get those suspects to face trial in the U.S., but really not look much beyond that.
Mm. John fought against that very strongly. It's funny, after the Oklahoma City bombing case, John O'Neill, through an act of the president, signed a directive that gave the FBI the lead in terrorism cases, which is just what John wanted. But he recognized right away that the Bin Laden Network was literally at war with us, and he fought against the idea that these were law enforcement matters. If you just stick with the 1993 case, the Twin Tower attack then, they identified six or seven suspects, and in the case of Ramzi Youssef, they eventually caught him and brought him here, and other ones. I mean, they captured a number of people right away, because they dopily went back to it. To a rental place to collect their deposit on their truck.
Right.
But Ramzi Youssef was too brilliant for that. He was already out of the country long before the truck was being returned later that day. But John argued that the problem was that people saw these cases as law enforcement matters. You know, it was the notion of small cases, small problems; big cases, big problems; no cases, no problems. In the case of of these kind of cases, they was like, well, let's make it a small case. We identify seven people. We arrest them. If we're lucky enough to get cooperation from Pakistan and bring Ramzi Youssef back here, great. And we try him. And that'll be the end of it. Put a nice little bow on it and done. John O'Neill was a man who saw that there were broader issues taking place. That these people were multinational. Most of them had fought in Afghanistan. Their roots ran through the Middle East and through Afghanistan in particular, and even as far as the Philippines. Which I fully didn't know this. So I'm willing to confess my own ignorance. You know, in the course of a book, you learn a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize how vast and a Muslim region the Philippines are. Probably, I think there are more Muslims there than anywhere in the world. so anyway, my point is he saw this. 1995, he started listening to Bin Laden's words, and he recognized that he actually compared him to a young Adolf Hitler. When Adolf Hitler wrote Mein Kampf, saying what he was going to do, if he took power, he was going to take power, and what he was going to do, and he did. And he said that Bin Laden is that way. This guy has got money, he's got people following him, and he's building this network. So on the notion of law enforcement, he actually, in a rare way, was trying to get the government to wake up to the fact we're at war and take this away from me. This is not a law enforcement matter.
Mm-hmm.
This requires a change at the State Department and in the White House, and the military should be considered as the people who should be taking the lead here. So, you know, he fought against that. It's very rare for government officials to want to cede their own territory and authority, particularly a guy like John O'Neill. He was a guy that fought. He saw big cases. He wanted big cases, and he brought unbelievable energy to them. I mean, this was a 20-hour-a-day guy at work. And then the other four, he went out and had himself a grand time and rubbing elbows with celebrities and in great restaurants. And, you know, he was everybody. He seemed to know everybody, certainly in New York and Chicago and Baltimore and Washington when he worked in those different places. He knew all the blessed restaurants and, you know, was friends with the mayors. And it's just incredible the wealth of contacts, and not just domestically here in the United States. He built a a palm pilot of friends and relations in law enforcement, intelligence, and royalty around the globe. His palm pilot was programmed by geography. If you walked up to him and you knew him and said, "Hey, I'm going to Spain. Is there anything you know anybody, or you know, what do I have to do paperwork-wise to get in?" And in a phone call, you know, you'd know people and you'd be wined and dined and taken care of. Extraordinary man.
We'll talk more about all those things. We have a caller to bring into the conversation, and we'll do that. I want to reintroduce our guest, Murray Weiss. W-E-I-S-S is the spelling of his last name, author of the book The Man Who Warned America. And we're talking about the life and death of John O'Neill, the FBI's embattled counterterror warrior. Other calls are welcome, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have an Urbana listener on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
Frontline actually did a special on John O'Neill, which people can still watch on the Internet. I'm sure you've seen that program. It kind of gives a nice overview of John O'Neill at his times. The question I had concerns, I remember on the Frontline report they talked about he and Louis Freed went to Saudi Arabia trying to get some information, I think, on the Khobar Towers. And it seemed that O'Neill felt that the Saudis were not really being straight with him. And I'm just wondering, how far ahead of the curve might he have been with the understanding of the threat from Saudi Arabia?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're on point, 100%. I have a very informative, I think, chapter. Very little has been written about the Khobar Tower case, and actually all the stories in my book. I run through, you go with John O'Neill and the agents to these different bombings. And in the Khobar Tower investigation, which I call the chapter The Obstructionists, I mean, you see directly what was going on there and how the FBI was blocked. For example, I interviewed an on-scene commander and other agents who flew, to Saudi Arabia. And I have to tell you that while the FBI gets criticized in the media and in general a lot for their failings, and I say they deserve the criticism when it occurs, you don't really see the flip side of it. You don't see the agents who board military planes and go flying to places like Saudi Arabia, and they go to these horrific bombing scenes. And as we know, just here in the United States from Oklahoma City and the World Trade Center, these events on television get miniaturized. You really don't see how devastating they are. And to be there where there's no water and running toilets and you're in these foreign hostile territories where it's 120 degrees. So I take you there. I take you there. As agents are now in Iraq at the UN headquarters, they're leading that investigation, in very dangerous territory. In Saudi Arabia, when they went there, the agents, I report from the agents who were there, it's recreated, it's not me, how the Saudis wouldn't allow them to even leave the base to begin to question anybody who, like, may have witnessed it, who lived in neighboring homes. So something as simple as that, Investigation 101, they thwarted. And then when, the FBI tried getting cooperation from them on some of the people they were holding, the Saudis do all their meetings at night. So the FBI would sit there and wait, and wait and wait. And I quote one FBI official saying they were like death marches, sitting and waiting, because they would say, "We'll meet you at 11, and then it would become 12, and it would be 1, and the next thing you know, you're not seeing them. So at every turn, they were thwarted. And there's actually, I have a brief passage about a previous bombing there at something I didn't know. I wasn't familiar with the name. Again, to show you what you learn as you go, it was called the OPM Sang bombing, which is the Office of Professional Managers, Saudi Arabian National Guard. And five people there was a bombing there. And I think more than a dozen people were killed. They had five people in custody. And fast forward, rather than let the United States have any interrogation of these people, they found them guilty and beheaded them within hours. So the Saudis, as far back as the Khobar Towers case, did all they could not to cooperate with the United States of America. And in fact, I report in my book that at different times they tried bribing Osama bin Laden with hundreds of millions of dollars if he would stop criticizing the Saudi government. You know, Bin Laden hated the Saudis probably more than he hated the United States because they brought the United, they allowed the United States to set up bases in Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis have been duplicitous for a long, long time. And it's a powerful chapter where you really get to see, you know, and again, you get to see it through the people who were there. You know, hey, I tried to go off the base and they blocked me, you know. And, you know, today the Saudis have, you know, suffered recently two major terrorist attacks on their own soil. And, you know, there is strong suggestion that they're waking up, that, you know, that they will, the hatred for them is as strong as it was before and that now they're targets too. But John O'Neill and Louis Free, I got to tell you, they worked tirelessly to get relationships going with the Saudis. I mean, John O'Neill put a group of Saudis here in New York in the Plaza Hotel when they came through here, and he sent the FBI a $25,000 expense bill because he said, these people are royalty. You got to treat them like royals. I mean, he would do anything in his charming and personality ways to win friends around the globe because he recognized that partnering up with people around the globe was the only way to really begin to attack al-Qaeda overseas. And that network is really a network he forged that's being used today.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. A couple of the callers waiting. There's much more on this issue of bin Laden and the Saudi government. Very interesting history there. At the time of the Gulf War, and you write about this, bin Laden had urged King Saud that there was no need for American troops to be let into Saudi Arabia to defeat Saddam Hussein. He said his own religious warriors could do it, so he was willing to team up with the Saudi government to defeat Saddam Hussein, to go to war with Saddam.
That's true. That's true, and I did write that. Right. He came back to the country. And he didn't want the United States to be there. You know, his view was, this is holy land. We're Muslims, and I just fought in Afghanistan. We beat the Russians. I'll call for a jihad against Saddam Hussein in Kuwait, and we'll drive him out. We don't need the Americans. But the Saudi government allowed the Americans. And of course, as I said earlier, bin Laden's anger toward the Saudis grew, and they exiled him. They exiled him out of the country, and at one or two points, they actually tried to kill him. So at different points, they tried to kill him, or they tried to bribe him, depending on what the time was. But the bottom line was that they did let the Americans in. And you know, John O'Neill said long time ago that he believed the way to dismantle, all the elements of dismantling bin Laden's network were in Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis are, if you want to even be fair to them, you know, they're in a very precarious spot. They're in a very Muslim area. They have tremendous oil. We want their oil. They enjoy to some degree the Western world, but they're in the belly of the beast over there too. So they can't be seen necessarily as caving into the United States at every turn. And that was the game they were playing. You know, we love you, we hate you. We'll help you, we won't help you. Bin Laden, we'll kill you, we'll bribe you. And I think that's the way it's been. And I'm sure, you know, that's still the way it is. I mean, they're still in a precarious spot, if you want to be the slightest bit fair to them.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of the callers to talk with. Let's go next to a listener on line number 2 in Champaign County. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Yeah, I happen to live at the Khobar neighborhood on June 25th, 1996, when the bombing happened.
Wow.
And our building shook while our villa shook. Pretty strong. We thought it was a sonic boom. We went out to check it out. We went to drive. We actually ended up driving to the area where the explosion happened. We were turned away, but it was very clear within a 72-hour period. It was extremely clear that the investigation was going to fail to all the Americans, Europeans that were around there because it was still, you know, same as usual. And as time went on, I mean, the Saudis were really arrogant, and I would say almost, you know, feeling fairly triumphant, knowing that the investigation wasn't going to get anywhere. And it was just so shocking. I just couldn't believe that the U.S. administration or the FBI, whoever was in charge, would just roll over. And if anybody thinks anything has changed, they're sorely mistaken. It's the same as it was back then, and I don't think it's going to change. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
No, frankly, that's a very welcome call. You know, it's the first time, I think, I've done a number of interviews. It's the first time that somebody, you know, I've talked about the Khobar Towers thing, who, you know, to some degree, you're almost like a plant. You know, you're supporting what was reported to me and what I reported in my book, that that the case was doomed. And I think people would be naive to think that the Saudis suddenly had this enormous change of heart. That doesn't mean they're not privately doing a little more, because I think they recognize that these bombings now are going to start attacking Saudi people. You know, there was once a plan. There was a plan to they hit the Khobar towers, or there were earlier plans to attack like the U.S. embassy. But because the U.S. embassy has a number of Saudis working in it, they chose a target that was, you know, in a way more American, if you will. That, of course, changed in the next attack. Next big attack, which was the two embassies in Africa. Only actually 14 Americans were killed, including a diplomat and a son who was over there working at the time. But the preponderance of people who were killed were actually African, you know, from the two African countries.
Mm-hmm.
But that demonstrated that bin Laden didn't care about civilians. And what when you read my book, or if you just, you know, I think we now, the public, you know, we recognize the last round of bin Laden tapes, the one that's most widely known is the one where he's sitting firing the AK-47 machine guns and the guy's training. But he had been making statements and issuing tapes and holding press accounts, and he allowed John Miller from ABC TV to visit him and tape him. And in those statements at different points, you know, bin Laden was saying what he's doing. And John O'Neill was reading this, seeing it, knowing it, and telling people, you know, this is what the guy is saying and this is what's going to happen. Unfortunately, the American public and at that time the Clinton administration, whether you like the Clinton administration or not, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, I mean, when I get into the African bombing case, it's clear from people who were in the White House, and I quote numerous of them, and I say what happened in the African case, and I take you there with the agents. Again, it's not an academic book. It's clear that the Clinton administration, on when it came to the terrorist issue, the Islamic fundamentalist terrorist issue, was distracted by his problems, his scandals. You can blame it on Congress if you want, or for attacking him over infidelities, and they were hounding him. But and you want, if you want to shift the blame from him to people who were hounding, to the Star people, or you want to get into a morality thing, but he was distracted. And to some degree, the American public was, too.
Yeah.
It was a roaring time, lots of money in the stock market. But in that case, he didn't even tell the FBI when he responded to bin Laden when he launched his Tomahawk strikes. And O'Neill claimed the information that they were using was outdated. They had 500 agents on the ground in Africa who were not warned, and they were in two Muslim countries, so they were sitting ducks, and Louis Free was among them. The director himself didn't know, but they had told the Pakistani intelligence people, and of course they leaked it to their friends, the Taliban, who leaked it to bin Laden. So the whole rather limp-wristed twin attack on a pharmaceutical plant in bin Laden's camp was really ill-fated and doomed from the start.
That is another interesting chapter, and we'll hopefully get back to that. I do want to include another caller and also mention that we're well past our midpoint here, and our guest is Murray Weiss. He's an investigative journalist. He writes criminal justice for the New York Post. He's a criminal justice editor there, and he's the author of the book we're discussing, The Man Who Warned America, recently published by Reagan Books. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number around Champaign-Urbana, again, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have another listener in Champaign County on line number 3 next. Good morning.
Good morning. My momentum to call was to ask you about Yemen, and it seems to be O'Neill was, you know, getting stonewalled by the Saudis is one thing, but getting impeded by your own administration, as he felt he was really what made him the most angry. But on the point you were just talking about, only on globalresearch.ca have I seen any kind of story about this, and I'm not sure how close in that is to the story. But there's an allegation that, well, we all know that the group that bin Laden took on and funded in Afghanistan was used there, but there are allegations that the Clinton administration sort of gave bin Laden and al-Qaeda a pass because they were helping out in Kosovo. They were, everyone knows that they've gone to Chechnya as well, some of the fighters that were trained by the CIA in South Asia. went there. But it's also there's an allegation that's why the Clinton administration didn't kind of let things go a little bit with Bin Laden, because he was being helpful in other places, actually. I don't know if you know about that.
Well, I've heard those kind of suspicions, theories, thoughts. I'm not so naive to think that things like that don't happen. Your viewers don't know me. I've covered law enforcement and criminal justice here in New York City mostly for, more than two decades, almost three. I hate to say that. I mean, I've covered countless murders and terrorists and mafia people and
police malfeasance.
in general, and corrupt politicians. But I don't want to be an ingenue on this, and I may be wrong, but I don't think that's why this happened.
I think the Sudan, turning down Sudan's offer may have been kind of a result of that. I don't actually know the timeline. What I'd like to see is somebody thoroughly investigate it.
That would be a fascinating thing to uncover. But
back to the story of Yemen, the woman that was third in command in the ill-fated Bremer,
Barbara Bodine.
But yeah, okay. First, the story of her shutting down his investigation in Yemen. I think that was sort of the... Would you say that was the coup de grace that made him totally furious?
Oh, absolutely. Have you read my book on
it? No.
Oh, okay. Because I have a lot of material in the Cole that's both poignant and powerful and on point, certainly, to her. I think you're 1,000% right on what that did to John O'Neill. John, at that time, here was the guy in charge of the al-Qaeda investigation. He's been in charge of the African bombing case, the Saudi case. He had been pounding the table and shaking people up in Washington, trying to get the White House to see what's going on. And now the Cole is bombed, and he leads the investigation. He goes to Yemen. He knows that it's Bin Laden's ancestral homeland. He knows that the African bombing case goes right through Yemen, that Dr. al-Zawahiri in Egypt goes right through Yemen, right into Afghanistan, right to Bin Laden. You know, so he knows what Yemen's all about. The ambassador... To set the stage here, the ambassador who had been in Kuwait, and she was there when Kuwait was overrun, and she did a more than heroic job of staying in the embassy, and actually she was awarded a commendation by the president. She's now in Yemen. It's her last posting. And she had been saying that the Yemeni government had been moderating, and she had lobbied for American ships to refuel in Yemeni ports. And so she was very much involved in a policy change, and the Clinton White House was very happy to do it because they wanted better relations with Yemen and some Muslim countries, because it was coming near the end of the Clinton administration, and he was looking for a legacy out of the Middle East. He was trying to solve the Israeli-Palestinian problem. And then the Cole is attacked. And, in fact, the president of Yemen was a very good friend of Saddam Hussein and actually backed him in the war in Kuwait. But, you know, this is a few years later, and this is where American policy was moving there. So now the Cole is bombed, which is an embarrassment for her to some degree. Here comes a hard-charging FBI terrorist guy who's now in Bin Laden's backyard, and he's like face-to-face with the enemy, if you will. And he understands how diplomacy works, but Miss Bodine tried to control the investigation at every turn. And at every turn, she wouldn't allow him the freedom to try to do what he wanted to do. And after about 6 weeks, he returns to New York. He's 25 pounds lighter by then. And Louis Free wants to send him back to jumpstart the investigation. And Barbara Bodine had developed such dislike for him that she declined to give him what they call country clearance, so he could not return to Yemen. So in effect, he became the first first FBI official in the history of the country to be barred entry to a foreign country by a U.S. official. And if you just fast forward months later, on Father's Day of 2001, maybe 9 weeks before 9/11, the threat level in Yemen was through the roof, and the principal targets was, of course, the American FBI agents. And O'Neill and Louis Free ordered them out of Yemen. And Ambassador Bodine, she didn't want him to leave. Why? Because it's basically an embarrassment that she can't protect him, the Yemenis can't protect him. So she orders the Marines and the diplomatic security at her compound to lock the doors and hold them there at gunpoint. And the agents actually say, like, what are you going to do, shoot us? And it took like a bizarre 3-hour standoff. It only ended when Washington called, and they let the agents go. So her behavior over there was certainly more than questionable. But if I may take 10 more seconds to tell you a humorous side to that. You know, the agents fly out of Yemen and they come back to McGuire Air Force Base in South Jersey. It's about a 3-hour drive from New York City. And they land on the tarmac after like 14 hours. And who's standing on the tarmac as fresh as a daisy, looking as dapper as ever, but John O'Neill. And that's the kind of guy he was. At 6:30 in the morning, he greeted them, hugged them, shook their hands, and saw that there were agents there to drive him home and congratulate him on being safe. But he was probably came from famous Elaine's restaurant. He probably drove at 3:30 in the morning from some celebrity haunt to meet these guys. The guy never slept. But that was him.
Yeah. Well, there are a number of things that I want to make sure we get to before we run out of time. We just have about 10 minutes left and another caller waiting. There's more to this story before we get to wrap up. But I can't resist asking about a story that is in the news as of yesterday. This is related to a suit brought against the government of Iraq by the former wife and children of John O'Neill,
right,
claiming that there were connections between al-Qaeda and Iraq as early as 1992.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know anything about that?
Well, I don't claim to be an expert on their lawsuit. You know, there are ties between al-Qaeda and Iraq at various points. Even though bin Laden didn't want to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, and he wasn't a fan of Saddam Hussein because Saddam Hussein wasn't a pure Muslim. There are clearly overlapping ties between Iraq and their intelligence people assisting al-Qaeda. I mean, you know, it's like my enemy's enemies are my friends, you know?
Right.
That's sort of the way it works in life here probably as well as over there.
Yeah.
So there, I think, you know, John O'Neill, although he was estranged from his wife for 18 years, I mean, he loved his children, and he tried taking care of everybody. You know, I'm sure he would applaud any suit that could get recompense from any people connected one way or another with the destruction on 9/11 and destruction elsewhere in the world.
Okay. And that raises another issue that you detail in the book, and that is his very difficult sort of approach to relationships with his wife and other women. He was carrying on several affairs at the same time.
Right. We don't, you know, we could be gentle here, and I think I handle all this in my book in a very good way, but I'm in an honest way. John O'Neill, when he died, was living with a woman here in New York. He was estranged from his wife, and he also had more than two other women that he was seeing. He somehow managed to compartmentalize his personal life. I can tell you he spent 20 hours a day working, so his personal life, you know, was really squeezed into the margins. His real love was the FBI. But, you know, the truth is, when he died on September 11th, predicting that the place would get attacked, actually he got out and went back in.
Yeah.
These women were shocked to find their great love and loss, but then they were equally shocked to find out that they were not the only woman in his life. And I thought it was important, and they cooperated with me.
Yeah.
It made writing the book much more difficult,
mm-hmm,
because it was a whole nother layer of reporting that needed to be done and woven into the story. But I thought it was important to put in there because, A, it was true and this was his life, but it also showed that while he was a super patriot and a visionary and almost a genius in seeing around the corner, and he worked tirelessly to prevent the kind of attacks that took his life and others here in the United States, he was not a perfect man. He was not a perfect man, but these women loved him, and I can tell you, while talking to him even to this day, as much as they were in shock to find out, you know, that there were others, there's an element of, you know, my life was much better for having known him, even though, you know, the great shock of knowing that I wasn't the only one.
Okay. Well, we have a couple callers. Let's go next to a listener in Savoy on line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, this is going to be real controversial, but you could talk about it anyway. You know, there was whenever the report on 9/11 was released by the Congress, you know, they went and they blotted out those 27 pages and they kind of pointed the fingers at the Saudi Arabian government. And there was a Saudi Arabian official, I guess, in San Francisco or Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
that there was allegations that actually two of the hijackers stayed at his apartment, possibly.
Right.
And he was flown, you know, he was flown out of New York back to Saudi Arabia on a private jet during the, you know, when everything else in this country was grounded.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's truth to some of that, you know, but some of it also is a bit of hyperbole too.
Do you think
you're asking me?
Have you ever thought for a moment that any of the hijackers were working for the FBI and they were being double crossed?
Have I thought about it?
Yeah.
I could sit here and try to appease you, and as I like to say, I could tell you what you might want to hear. I didn't really think of that, no, and I don't believe that's the case either.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, in my book, you know, I interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people, and they're all on the record, and these are the, you know, key people in all of these cases.
Yeah.
And it's just, I can only promise you, I mean, I don't know you, but if I talk to you about things and you're a fairly upstanding, honest person, I have no reason to sort of doubt you.
Okay, I was just wondering, you've sounded like you've investigated this pretty thoroughly, and I've wondered about that too, you know, it would seem not out of the question, but,
you know, anything,
pretty remote.
You could argue any possible scenario you want, you know, but generally things happen the way they happen in the simplest way. It's kind of like the laws of physics. I learned a lot by covering murder here in New York, you know. Generally it is what it is, and it works the way it works. And in the case of 9/11, the whole lesson in history of John O'Neill shows, you know, what things went wrong at the White House, the problems with the CIA and the FBI that he tried to break down by bringing FBI officials over to work with him in J. Edgar Hoover's building. And the stories that have come out, you know, Colleen Rowley in Michigan trying to get into Massawi's computers, the Kenneth Williams agent letter from the Southwest about, you know, Middle Eastern types trying to get flight lessons. I mean, it's pretty clear what kind of dots and cracks and things fell between that could have changed fate.
Mm-hmm.
You know? To start to think, well, you know, the hijackers were also part of the FBI, I mean, you can see where the errors are, and it generally is what it is. I don't think you need necessarily theorize even more things. I think it's the dots that were missed, you know, they were there, and John O'Neill fought against all the things that went wrong, all of them. The sharing of information, aggressive investigation, tearing down the walls between the CIA and the FBI, getting the State Department to wake up that, you know, you can't go with the status quo, getting the White House to recognize, you know, that they got to put their own political ambitions out of the way for the way the world is really working. I mean, these were things that he fought against, and they squeezed him out. You know, they didn't like his style. He was too flamboyant. He ruffled feathers. They don't like mavericks. You know, they love them when they're coming up through the ranks. That's the way bureaucracies are. You know, oh, good, we got somebody who can identify a problem, bring energy, and solve it. But when that person gets to the rank where they could be the director or the deputy director, you know, people who wind up there very often aren't risk takers. And that's how you get there. So John gets squeezed out, and in those final months when all these important events were taking place, he was telling people something big's going to happen. But right up to the night he died, even while he was standing under the towers while they were burning. He called an agent in Yemen after calling his loved ones. I'm sorry, he called an agent in Los Angeles who worked with him in Yemen, and they had debated one night during the call investigation whether the towers would get hit. And John said they're going to keep coming to him. And he called the guy to say, I told you so, and then he went back into the towers after helping some kids out, and he died. But that was the kind of guy he was.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to have you talk about how essentially he was, I'm not sure forced out of the FBI is the way to put it, but he made a couple of mistakes that put pressure on him to leave, and he finally decided to leave.
No doubt, that's 100% true. John, one was very minor. He was driving in Atlantic City with the woman that he was living with here in New York City. His car breaks down. He goes to an FBI garage to get his government car, and he allows his girlfriend into the facility to use a bathroom. And all of that is like a no-no. You know, civilians can't come to these garages where these so-called secret warehouses where they keep their equipment. So it's a violation. And in the FBI, which is a very rigid bureaucracy to begin with, and particularly under Louis Free, he had edicts about, you know, right and wrong, and there's no gray. You know, and you get punished, particularly people on John's level, because, you know, agents watch how the bosses get disciplined as opposed to how the little guys get disciplined. And it stayed on your record, and you can't get promoted for like 3 years. And then the 3 years pass, and John goes to a retirement seminar in Florida. And he's the kind of guy that spent his own money. He was maxed out on his debit card, you know, whining and dining, not just himself, but everybody from around the world to build his contacts. That's the kind of guy he was. And he never saw himself as somebody's going to live long enough to even use his pension money. But he's got to go to his retirement thing. He goes to it. But he was pressed to finish an annual report on what his office was doing here in New York. And he brought it with him. And he got paged. Couldn't hear on his cell phone, stepped out of the room, and what happens? Some petty little burglar kind of guy in Miami grabs his briefcase and takes it, and it's missing for like an hour or two. They find it. They determine that there's no compromise to the FBI's secrets that he carried with him. You're not supposed to take classified stuff out of an FBI building. He did, albeit for, you know, good reasons, and he knew that this was like a mega no-no. And they made a federal case out of it. You know, they investigated whether he did it on purpose, you know. Perhaps he was a mole for the Russians or for Al-Qaeda, you know. Who knows? Which, of course, was preposterous. But, you know, they made a big deal of it, and he knew that he couldn't get any higher. And even though he went after that to Yemen to lead the investigation on the coal, that's how much faith they had in him. But when they didn't back him enough to send him back to Yemen over the U.S. ambassador, by then he felt betrayed, not fully supported. They weren't listening to his clarion call about bin Laden. And he just saw that, you know, after 30 years in the Bureau and even dreaming of being an FBI agent since he was 9 years old in Atlantic City, growing up in Atlantic City, he thought the unthinkable, and maybe it's time for me to go.
And he had an offer to head security at the World Trade Center.
And that came along, and by that time he was in love with New York City, because that was kind of bigger than, you know, he was a big city kind of guy in the end. And he saw that as an opportunity to stay, you know, kind of in the game, in the fight, also on an international kind of level that he had been on. And he saw that as a great way to stay in New York, too. And, you know, it fit for his downsized war on bin Laden and for the kind of grand life he had built for himself. I mean, you know, he's the son of two cab drivers in Atlantic City. His mom still drives a cab down there. You know, he had lived out his dream. And I don't want your listeners to think, you know, that despite the tragedy of 9/11 and his early death at the age of 49, he had an amazing grand life that he built for himself. He lived his dream. And I think he always thought he wouldn't, you know, live a long life. But, you know, he was on the cutting edge of everything on a global level, and he enjoyed life. He loved people. He loved women. So in some ways, he lived a grander life than 20 people could live.
Well, we're going to have to stop there since we're out of time. There's much more in the book. And so if you'd like to know more, you can read it. The title is The Man Who Warned America, The Life and Death of John O'Neill, the FBI's Embattled Counterterror Warrior, recently published by Reagan Books, an imprint of HarperCollins. The author is Murray Weiss, W-E-I-S-S is the spelling of his name. And Murray Weiss has been our guest. I want to thank you so much for giving us your time today.
No, thank you so much for having me.
All right.